The rain was clean on his face. He walked slowly to the rail where the horses were tethered. Gentle traveler, skittish Lucy Long. Stuart had not come back in the night. If Stuart had come, they would have wakened him. He said good morning to the beautiful gray horse. The great soft eyes said a silent prayer. He thought, tonight we'll all be together. Troops were gathering along the rail fence, looking in at him. He heard a man cry a raucous greeting. Another man shushed him in anger. Lee turned, bowed slightly, waved a stiff arm. There was a cluster of sloppy salutes, broad, wet grins under dripping hats. A bareheaded boy stood in reverent silence, black hat clutched to his breast. An officer moved down the fence, hustling the men away. Lee took a deep breath, testing his chest. A wind-blown vacancy, a breathless pain. He had a sense of enormous, unnatural fragility, like hollow glass. He sat silently on a rail, letting the velvet nose nuzzle him. Not much pain this morning. Praise God. He had fallen from his horse on his hands, and the hands still hurt him, but the pain in his chest was not bad at all. But it was not the pain that troubled him. It was a sick, gray emptiness he knew too well. That sense of a hole clear through him like the blasted vacancy in the air behind a shell burst. An enormous emptiness. The thing about the heart was that you could not coax it or force it, as you could any other disease. Willpower meant nothing. The great, cold message had come in the spring, and Lee carried it inside him every moment of every day and all through the nights, that endless, breathless, inconsolable alarm. There is not much time. Beware. Prepare. Sir? Lee looked up. Young Walter Taylor. Lee came slowly awake, back to the misty world. Taylor stood in the rain with inky papers. A cool boy of 24. Already a major.
Good morning, sir. Trust you slept well?
The clear black eyes were concerned. Lee nodded. Taylor was a slim and cocky boy. Behind Lee's back, he called him the Great Tycoon. He did not know that Lee knew it. He had a delicate face, sensitive nostrils. He said cheerily, "Nothing from General Stuart, sir." Lee nodded.
"Not a thing, sir. We can't even pick up any rumors. But we mustn't fret now, sir."
A consoling tone. "They haven't got anybody can catch General Stuart." Lee turned to the beautiful horse. He had a sudden rushing sensation of human frailty. Death like a blowing wind. Jackson was gone. Stuart would go, like leaves from autumn trees. Matter of time.
Taylor said airily, "Sir, I would assume that if we haven't heard from the general, it is obviously because he has nothing to report."
"Perhaps," Lee said.
"After all, sir, Longstreet's man is a paid spy, and an actor to boot."
Taylor pursed his lips primly, flicked water from a gray cuff. Lee said, "If I do not hear from General Stuart by this evening, I will have to send for him."
"Yes, sir."
"We'll send the Maryland people. They'll be familiar with the ground."
"Very good, sir."
Taylor shifted wet papers.
"Message here from General Hill, sir."
"Yes?"
"The general wishes to inform you that he is going into Gettysburg this morning with his lead division."
Taylor squinted upward at a lightening sky.
"I expect he's already underway. He advises me that there is a shoe factory in the town, and his men intend to, requisition some footgear."
Taylor grinned. "General Ewell is moving down from the north?"
"Yes, sir. The rain may slow things somewhat, but General Ewell expects to be in the Cashtown area by noon."
Lee nodded. Taylor peered distastefully at another paper.
There is a report here, sir, of Union cavalry in Gettysburg, but General Hill discounts it."
"Cavalry?"
"Yes, sir. General Pettigrew claims he saw them yesterday afternoon. General Hill says he was, over-eager. General Hill says he expects no opposition, but perhaps some local militia with shotguns and such. Taylor grinned cheerily. Lee remembered Longstreet's spy. If it is Union cavalry, there will be infantry close behind it. Lee said, "Who is Hill's lead commander?"
That will be General Heath, sir.
Harry Heath. Studious, reliable. Lee said, "General Hill knows I want no fight until this army is concentrated."
"Sir, he does. That must be clear."
"I believe it is, sir."
Lee felt a thump, a flutter in his chest. It was as if the heart was turning over. He put his hand there, past one small, breathless moment. It happened often. No pain, just a soft, deep flutter. Taylor was eyeing him placidly. He had no fear of the Army of the Potomac.
"Will the general have breakfast?"
Lee shook his head.
"We have flapjacks in Small Mountain, sir."
"You must try them, sir. Fresh butter and bacon and wagons of hams, apple butter, ripe cherries. Never seen anything like it, sir. You really ought to pitch in. Courtesy of mine host, the great state of Pennsylvania. Nothing like it since the war began. Marvelous what it does for morale. Never saw the men happier. Napoleon knew a thing or two, what? For a Frenchman?"
Lee said, "Later." There was no hunger in the glassy chest. Want to see Longstreet. Up ahead in the mist, A.P. Hill probes toward Gettysburg like a blind hand. Hill was new to command. One-legged Ewell was new to command. Both had replaced Stonewall Jackson, who was perhaps irreplaceable. Now there was only Longstreet and a thumping heart. Lee said, "We will move the headquarters forward today, this morning."
"Yes, sir."
"Sir, there are a number of civilians to see you."
Lee turned sharply.
"Trouble with our soldiers?"
"Oh, no, sir. No problem there. The men are behaving very well indeed."
"Oh, yes, sir.
But, there are some local women who claim we've taken all their food, and although they don't complain of our having paid for it all in the good dear coin of the mighty state of Virginia," Taylor grinned, "they do object to starving."
"I must say that Ewell's raiding parties do seem to have been thorough. At any rate, the ladies seek your assistance."
"Rather massive ladies, most of them, but one or two have charm."
"See to it, Major."
"Of course, sir. Except, sir, the old gentleman, he's been waiting all night to see you."
"Old gentleman?"
"Well, sir, we conscripted his horse, at your orders, as you know. I explained that to the old man, fortunes of war and all that, but the old gentleman insists that the horse is blind and can be of no use to us, and is an old friend."
Lee sighed. "A blind horse?"
"Yes, sir. I didn't want to trouble you, sir, but your orders were strict on this point."
"Give him the horse, Major."
"Yes, sir."
Taylor nodded. "We must be charitable with these people, Major. We have enough enemies."
"Oh, yes, sir."
Taylor made a slight bow.
"The men have the strictest orders, but I must say, sir, that those orders would be easier to follow had the Yankees shown charity when they were back in Virginia."
"Major," Lee said slowly, "we will behave ourselves." Taylor recognized the tone.
"Yes, sir," he said.
Lee rested against the rail fence. He noticed at last a struggling band. Bonnie Blue Flag. A brave but tinny sound. He bowed in that direction, raised his coffee cup in tribute. A tall, thin soldier waved a feathered hat. The music bounced away. Lee said, "I would like to see General Longstreet. My compliments, and ask him to ride with me this morning, if he is not otherwise occupied."
"Breakfast, sir?"
"In a moment, Major." Taylor saluted formally, moved off. Lee sat for a moment alone, gazing eastward. Cavalry. If Longstreet's spy was right, then there could truly be cavalry in Gettysburg and masses of infantry right behind.
we drift blindly toward a great collision. Peace, until night. He rubbed the left arm. Must show no pain, no weakness here. The strength now is in Longstreet. Trust to him. He saw the old gentleman, who thanked him with tears for the return of the blind horse. A Pennsylvania woman flirted, asked for his autograph. He gave it, amazed, wondering what good it would do her in this country. He met with his aides, angry Marshall, gray-bearded Venable. Marshall was furious with the absent steward, was ready to draw up court-martial papers. Lee said nothing. The courteous Venable drew him politely away.
"Sir, I have a request to make."
"Yes?" Venable, a courtly man, a man of patience, he said, "Could you speak to Dorsey Pender, sir? He's had a letter from his wife." Lee remembered. Beautiful woman on a golden horse, riding with Pender on the banks of the Rappahannock. Lovely sight. A sunset sky. "Mrs. Pender is a pious woman, and she believes that now that we have invaded Pennsylvania, we are in the wrong, and God has forsaken us. You know how these people reason, sir. And she says she cannot pray for him." Lee shook his head. "God protect us from our loving friends." He saw for one small moment the tragic face of his own frail wife, that unhappy woman, the stone-strong face of his mother. Venable said, "I think a talk might help Pender, sir. Another man would shake it off, but he's taken it badly. Says he cannot pray himself." Venable paused. "I know there are others who feel that way." Lee nodded. Venable said, "It was easier in Virginia, sir, on our home ground."
"I know."
"Will you speak to him, sir?"
"Yes," Lee said.
"Very good, sir. I know it will help him, sir." Lee said, "I once swore to defend this ground." He looked out across the misty grove. "No matter. No matter. We end the war as best we can." He put his hand to his chest. "Napoleon once said, the logical end to defensive warfare is surrender. You might tell him that."
"Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir."
Venable went away. Lee felt a deeper spasm, like a black stain. "I swore to defend. Now I invade. A soldier, no theologian. God, let it be over soon. While there's time to play with grandchildren. It came too late. Fame came too late. I would have enjoyed it if I were a younger man." He moved back to the map table. The guilt stayed with him, ineradicable, like the silent alarm in the fragile chest. Swore to defend. Misty matters. Get on with the fight. He looked down at the map. The roads all converged web-like to Gettysburg. And where's the spider? 9 roads in all. Message from Ewell. His troops were on the move, would be coming down into Gettysburg from the north. Lee looked at his watch. 8 o'clock. The rain had stopped. The mist was blowing off. He thought, good. Too much rain would muck up the road. The first sun broke through, yellow and warm through steaming tree leaves. Broad, bright light blazed across the map table. Lee began to come slowly awake, blinking in the blaze of morning. Out on the road, the troops were moving in a great mottled stream. Longstreet's First Corps, the backbone of the army, moving up behind Powell Hill. The barefoot, sunburned, thin and grinning army, joyful, unbeatable, already immortal. And then through the trees, the familiar form. Big man on a black horse, great round shoulders, head thick as a stump. James Longstreet. It was reassuring just to look at him, riding slowly forward into the sunlight on the black Irish stallion. Dutch Longstreet. Old Pete. He was riding along in a cloud of visitors, bright-clad foreigners, observers from Europe, plumes and feathers and helmeted horsemen, reporters from Richmond, the solemn members of Longstreet's staff. He separated from the group and rode to Lee's tent, and the motley bright cloud remained respectfully distant. Lee rose with unconscious joy. "General!"
"Morning."
Longstreet touched his cap, came heavily down from the horse. He was taller than Lee, head like a boulder, full-bearded, long-haired, always a bit sloppy, gloomy. Shocked his staff by going into battle once wearing carpet slippers. Never cared much for appearance. Gave an impression of ominous, bad-tempered strength, and a kind of slow, even, stubborn, unquenchable anger. A soft voice, a ragged mouth. He talked very slowly and sometimes had trouble finding the right word, and the first impression of him around that gay and courtly camp was that he was rather dull-witted and not much fun. He was not a Virginian, but he was a magnificent soldier. With Jackson gone, he was the rock of the army, and Lee felt a new clutching in his chest, looking at him, thinking that this was one man you could not afford to lose. Longstreet smiled his ragged smile, grumbled, jerked a finger over his shoulder.
"Her Majesty's forces in the New World passed a restful night."
Lee looked, saw the ludicrous man in the lustrous hat and the wide gray coat. The man made a sweeping, quixotic bow, nearly falling from the horse. Colonel Freemantle was up. Lee gave a formal bow, smiling inwardly. Longstreet observed with slow-eyed surprise,
"After a while, you know, he actually begins to grow on you."
"You're keeping him entertained?"
"Not exactly. He's got his heart set on a cavalry charge, drawn sabers, all that glorious French business. He was horrified when I had to tell him we didn't use the British square."
Lee smiled.
"But he's a likable fella."
Longstreet took off his hat, scratched his head.
"Can't say he's learning much, but he seems to like us all right. He says you have a great reputation in Europe."
Lee said, "There'll be no help from there."
"No.
President Davis has hope."
"Well, I guess that won't do him any harm to hope."
"At least we'll be good hosts." Lee felt a sudden strength. It came out of Longstreet like sunlight. Lee said happily, "And how are you this morning, General?"
"Me?" Longstreet blinked. "I'm all right."
He paused, cocked his head to one side, stared at the old man. Lee said happily, "You must take care of yourself." Longstreet was mystified. No one had ever asked him how he felt. His health was legendary. He never tired. Lee said diplomatically, "The old soldier's illness is going around."
"It's the damn cherries," Longstreet gloomed. "Too many raw cherries."
Lee nodded. Then he said softly, "General, in the fight that's coming, I want you to stay back from the main line." Longstreet looked at him, expressionless. Black eyes glistened bright and hard under hairy eyebrows. Impossible to tell what he was thinking. Lee said, "You are my only veteran commander." Longstreet nodded. "If I should become once again indisposed," Lee said.
"God forbid." Longstreet stared. "And how are you?"
Lee smiled, waved a deprecating hand. "I am well, very well, thank God, but there is always a possibility. And now Jackson is gone, and we must all do more than before. And I do not know if Hill or Ewell are ready for command, but I know that you..." He paused, hard to speak in this fashion. Longstreet was staring with cold, silent eyes. Lee said sternly, "You have a very bad habit, General, of going too far forward." Longstreet said,
"You cannot lead from behind."
"Well, let me put it plainly. I cannot spare you." Longstreet stood silent for a moment, He bowed slightly. Then he grinned.
"True," he said.
"You will oblige me?"
"My pleasure," Longstreet said.
Lee rubbed his nose, looked down at the table. "Now, let us look to the day. Nothing will happen today. But we have an opportunity, I believe."
"Nothing from Stewart."
Lee shook his head. Longstreet grumbled.
"The Federals are closing in."
"I have no new information."
"When Stewart comes back, if he does come back, which he will eventually, if only just to read the Richmond newspapers, you ought to court-martial him."
"And will that make him a better soldier?" Longstreet paused. He said,
"All right. What will?"
"Reproach, I think. I must let him know how badly he has let us down."
Longstreet chuckled. He shook his head, gazing at Lee. "Yes, by George, maybe. Reproach from you?" "Yes." Longstreet grinned widely. "Might do the job. But me, I'm no good at that."
"Different men, different methods. Docile men make very poor soldiers." Longstreet grinned wryly.
"An army of temperamentals. It isn't an army. It's a gentleman's club. My God. Remember when old Powell Hill wanted to fight me in a duel? Right in the middle of the war?"
"And you ignored him. You did exactly right."
"Yep. He might have shot me."
Lee smiled. His heart rolled again, a soft thump, leaving him breathless. Longstreet was grinning, staring off toward the road, did not notice. Lee said, "One new item. I have confirmed some of your man Harrison's information. The new commander is definitely George Meade, not Reynolds. The news is carried in the local newspapers." Longstreet reached inside his coat, extracted a fat cigar.
"You can trust my man, I think. I sent him into Gettysburg last night. He said he saw two brigades of Union cavalry there."
"Last night?"
"I sent you a report."
Lee felt a tightening in his chest. He put his hand to his arm. He said slowly, "General Hill reports only militia."
"It's cavalry, I think."
Longstreet chewed, spat. "Where there is cavalry, there will be infantry close behind." "Whose troops?"
"John Buford."
Longstreet meditated.
"Meade's coming fast. Looks like he's trying to get behind us."
"Yes," Lee thought. "The direction does not matter. Fight him wherever he is." Lee said, "We have an opportunity." Longstreet chewed, nodded, grinned.
"Yep. Objective was to get him out of Washington and in the open. Now he's out. Now all we have to do is swing round between him and Washington and get astride some nice thick rocks and make him come to us, and we've got him in the open."
"Take the defensive. Not again." Lee shook his head. He pointed to Gettysburg. "He has been forcing the march. The weather has been unusually hot. He will arrive strung out and tired, piece by piece. If we concentrate, we can hit him as he comes up. If we ruin one or two corps, we can even the odds." He was again breathless, but he bent over the map. Longstreet said nothing. "He's new to command," Lee said. "It will take him some days to pick up the reins. His information will be poor. He will have staff problems."
"Yes, and he will have Washington on his back urging him to throw us out of Pennsylvania. He has to fight. We don't."
Lee put his hand to his eyes. He was fuzzy-brained. Longstreet loved the defense, but all the bright theories so rarely worked. Instinct said, "Hit hard, hit quick, hit everything." But he listened. Then he said slowly, "That move will be what Meade expects."
"Yes, because he fears it.
Lee turned away from the table. He wanted no argument now. He had been down this road before, and Longstreet was immovable, and there was no point in argument when you did not even know where the enemy was. Yet it was good counsel. Trust Longstreet to tell the truth. Lee looked up, and there was Traveler, led by a black groom. The staff had gathered, the tents were down. Time to move. Lee took a deep, delighted breath.
"Now, General," he said, "let's go see what George Meade intends."
They moved out into the open, into the warm sunlight. It was becoming a marvelous day. Out on the road, the army flowed endlessly eastward, pouring toward the great fight. Lee smelled the superb wetness of clean mountain air. He said, "General, will you ride with me?" Longstreet bowed.
"My pleasure."
Lee mounted in pain, but the hot sun would heal the old bones. They rode out into a space in the great gray bristling stream. Another band played. Men were shouting. It was lovely country. They rode through soft green rounded hills, a sunny morn, a splendid air, moving toward adventure, as rode the plumed knights of old. Far back in the woods, there was still fog in the trees, caught in the branches like fragments of white summer. And Lee remembered, "Bow down thy heavens, O Lord, and come down, touch the mountains, and they shall smoke." He closed his eyes. "Blessed be the Lord, my strength, which teacheth my fingers to fight and my hands to war. Amen." They rode several miles before they heard the first thunder. Lee reined to a stop. Silence. Motion of ragged white clouds. He said, "Did you hear that?" Longstreet, who was slightly deaf, shook his head. "It might have been thunder." But Lee waited. Then it came. Low, distant thumping. Ominous. Angry. Longstreet said grimly, bright-eyed, angered,
"I don't hear too well anymore."
"That was artillery," Lee said. Longstreet gazed at him with black marble eyes.
"You don't think,"
Lee began, then stopped. "I'd better ride forward," he said. Longstreet nodded. Lee looked at his watch. Not quite 10 in the morning. He left Longstreet and rode toward the sound of the gun. Buford. Just before dawn, Buford rode down the line himself, waking them up, all the boyish faces. Then he climbed the ladder into the white cupola and sat listening to the rain, watching the light come. The air was cool and wet and delicious to breathe, a slow, fine, soaking rain, a farmer's rain, gentle on the roof. The light came slowly. There were great trees out in the mist. Then the guns began. A single shot. He sat up. Another. Two more, widely spaced. Then a small volley. A spattering. A long silence. Several seconds. He stared at white air, the rounded tops of smoky trees. Men were moving out in the open below him. An officer paused on horseback in the road. The firing began again. Rebel guns, farther off, but not many. Buford was cold. He shuddered, waited. The first attack was very short, a ragged fire. Buford nodded, listening.
"Yes. Tried to brush us off. Got a bloody nose. Now he'll get angry, all puffed up like a partridge. Now he'll form a line and try us for real, and he'll hit the main line."
The mist was lifting slowly, the rain was slackening, but Buford could not see the line. He felt the attack come, and turned his face toward the sound of the guns, judging the size of the attack by the width of the sound, and he sat grinning alone in the cupola, while the rebel troops pushed his line and drew back, bloody, and tried again in another place, the firing spreading all down the line like a popping fuse. And then there was another long silence, and Buford could feel them reforming again, beginning for the first time to take this seriously. The next assault would be organized. He looked at his watch. Reynolds should be awake by now. They will have eaten their breakfast now, the infantry, and maybe they're on the march. There was a silence. He climbed down out of the cupola. The staff waited, white-faced, under dripping trees. Buford asked for coffee. He went back inside the seminary and waited for the firing to begin again before sending his first word to Reynolds. It took longer than he expected. If whoever was out there attacking him had any brains, he would probe this position first and find out what he was attacking. Buford listened for the scattered fire of patrols coming in, moving along his flanks, outlining him. But there was nothing. A long silence. Then a massed assault. Buford grinned, baring fangs. Damn fool! He's got a brigade in position, that's all. He's hitting me with one brigade, and I'm dug in. Lovely! Lovely! He wrote to Reynolds. Rebel infantry attacked at dawn. Am holding west of Gettysburg, expecting relief. John Buford. The fire was hotting up. He heard the first cannon. Caliph's battery opening up down the road. Grinned again. No Reb cannon to reply. Not yet. He sent the messenger off into the mist, climbed again into the cupola. The light was much clearer. He saw speckles of yellow fire through the mist. Winking guns. The road ran black through misty fields. He saw one black cannon spout red fire at the limits of his vision. On the far side of the road, there was a deep railroad cut. An unfinished railroad. He had not noticed it before. He saw horsemen moving behind the line. Then he heard that ripply sound that raised the hair. That high, thin scream from far away, coming out of the mist, unbodied and terrible, inhuman. It got inside him for a suspended second. The scream of a flood of charging men. The rebel yell. It died in massive fire. There were still no cannon on the other side. Caliph's battery blasted the mist, thunder among the lighter fire. The assault began to die away. The wounded were beginning to come back off the line. Buford went down from the cupola, restless, found Bill Gamble in the field by Caliph's battery, checking ammunition. There was blood on his left sleeve. His nose was still running. He grinned wetly at Buford.
Hey, General, that was quite a scrap. How are your losses? Not bad, not bad at all. We were dug in pretty good. We got 'em right out in the open, really got a twist on 'em. Arrogant people, you know that? Came right at us. Listen, we got some prisoners. I talked to 'em. They're Harry Heath's division of Hill's Corps. That's what I've got in front of me.
Buford nodded. Gamble was talking very quickly, head moving in jerky twitches.
Sir, as I remember, Heath's got near 10,000 men. They're all within sound of the fight back that road, between here and Cashtown.
Buford squinted. The rain had quit, but the sky was still low and gray. He could see a long way off through the trees, and there were ragged bodies in the fields. Groups of men digging, cutting trees for cover. Gamble said,
Sir, he'll be back with all 10,000.
It'll take him a while to deploy, Buford said.
Yes, but he's got Hill's whole corps behind him. Maybe 25,000, and Longstreet behind that, and Ewell in the north.
I know.
Thing is this, when John Reynolds gets here, he won't have the whole army with him, only a part of it. Point is, he sniffled, wiped his nose, as I see it, the Rebs will be here this afternoon with everything they've got.
Buford said nothing. Gamble sniffed cheerily.
Just thought I'd mention it. Now, what do you want me to do here?
Buford thought. If it was a mistake, God help us.
Heath will be back in a bit, Buford said. If he's got any brains at all, and he's not stupid, he'll know by now that he's got a brigade in front of him. Don't think he'll wait to get his whole division in line. That would take half the morning.
He doesn't need his whole division.
Right. Does Devon report any activity on his front?
Not a thing.
All right. I'll have Devon pull some of his people out and leave a cover in the north and have him dig in alongside, lengthening your line. When Heath comes back, he'll run into two brigades.
That should hold him until Reynolds gets here.
Right, Gamble said. He peered up at the sky. Glad the rain is gone. Don't want anything to slow up Reynolds. Take care of yourself. You know me. The soul of caution.
Buford moved off toward the north. He sent a second message to Reynolds. He pulled Devon out of line in the north and brought him in alongside Gamble, 2,000 men facing west. All that while, whenever he came near the line, he could see enemy troops moving in the fields across the way, spreading out as they came down the road, like a gray river spreading where it reaches the sea. If Heath was efficient and deliberate, he had the power to come straight through like an avalanche. Buford could hear the artillery coming into place on the far side, heard the spattering of rifle fire from probing patrols. He looked at his watch. It was after 8. Reynolds had to be on the road. The infantry had to be coming. He rode back and forth along the line, watched Devon's men digging in, heard bullets clip leaves above him as snipers crawled closer. We cannot hold 10,000. Not for very long. If Heath attacks in force, he will roll right over us, and we lose the 2 brigades and the high ground, too, and it will have been my fault. And the road in the north is open. They can come in there, and they'll be behind us, on our flank. There was nothing he could do about that. He had no more troops. But he pulled his squad out of Devon's line and put the young lieutenant with corn silk hair in charge and gave him orders. Son, you ride on out that road to the north about 5 miles. You squad across some high ground where you can see. First sign you get of enemy coming down that road, you ride like hell this way and tell me. Understand? The squad galloped off. A cannon shell burst in the air nearby, raining fragments in the wet leaves around him. The first Reb cannon were in position, limbering up easily, casually, getting the range. Now Buford had a little time to think. It all depends on how fast Reynolds comes. It all depends on how many men he's got with him and how fast Lee is moving this way. Nothing to do but fight now and hold this line. But he kept looking at his watch. There ought to be some word. He galloped back to the seminary and climbed the cupola and gazed back to that southern road, but there was nothing there. A short while after that, he saw the enemy come out in the open, line after line, heard the guns open up, dozens of guns, watched his own line disappear in smoke. The big attack had come. Gamble was down. The first report was very bad, and Buford rode over and took command. But it was only concussion, and Gamble was back on his feet in a few moments, ragged and dirty. There was a breakthrough on the right, but some junior officers patched it. Lone infantry began bending around the right flank. Buford mounted some men and drove them off. There were moments in smoke when he could not see and thought the line was going. One time when a shell burst very close and left him deaf and still and floating, like a bloody cloud. On the right there was another breakthrough, hand-to-hand fighting. He rode that way, leaping wounded, but it had been repulsed when he got there. One by one, Caliph's guns were being silenced. No one had yet broken away, no one was running, but Buford could feel them giving like a dam. He rode back to the seminary, looked down the road. Nothing. Not much more time. He felt the beginning of an awful anger, an unbearable sadness. Suppressed it. He rode back to the line. The fire was weakening. He stood irresolute in the road. An aide suggested he go to cover. He listened. The Rebs were pulling back, forming to come again. But the Reb cannon were pounding, pounding. He heard the great whirring of fragments in the air, saw air bursts and bright electric sparks. He rode slowly along the smoking line, looking at the faces. The brigades were wrecked. There was not much ammunition. They were down in the dirt, firing slowly, carefully from behind splintery trees, piled gray rails, mounds of raw dirt. They had maybe half an hour. Pull out before then. Save something. He rode back toward the seminary. He climbed the cupola, looked out across the field of war. Wreckage everywhere. Mounded bodies, smoking earth, naked stumps of trees. He could see a long way now above the rolling smoke which had replaced the mist. and the road coming down from the far-off mountains was packed with soldiers, thousands of soldiers, sunlight glittering on jeweled guns. He looked toward the south, and there was Reynolds. He was coming at a gallop across the fields to the south, a line of aides strung out behind him, cutting across the field to save time. No mistaking him. Matchless rider gliding over rail fences in parade ground precision, effortless motion, always a superb rider. Buford blinked, wiped his face, thanked God. But the road behind Reynolds was empty. The general rode into the yard below, dismounted. Buford waited in the cupola, weariness suddenly beginning to get to him in waves. In a moment, Reynolds was up the ladder. "Good morning, John." An immaculate man, tidy as a photograph, soft-voiced, almost elegant. Buford put out a hand. "General, I'm damn glad to see you." Reynolds stepped up for a look. Buford explained the position. In all his life, he had never been so happy to see anybody. But where was the infantry? Reynolds swung, pointed a gloved hand. The blue line had come around the bend. Buford saw with a slight shock the first column of infantry, the lovely flags. Reynolds said softly, "That's the First Corps. The 11th is right behind it." Buford watched them come. He leaned against the side of the cupola. Reynolds had turned, was surveying the hills to the south. There was a set, hard, formal look to him, but a happiness in his eyes. Buford thought, "He has brains to see." Reynolds said, "Good job, John." "Thank you." "This is going to be very interesting." "Yes," Buford said. "They seem to be forming for another assault. That's Harry Heath, isn't it?" "Very good. He'll come in here thinking he's up against two very tired cavalry brigades, and instead he'll be hitting two corps of fresh Union infantry." Reynolds smiled slightly. "Poor Harry," he said.
"Yes, sir," Buford said.
"You can start pulling your boys out, as soon as we set up." "Well done. Well done indeed. You can put them out on my flanks. Keep an eye on that north road. I expect Dick Ewell to be coming in shortly."
"Yes, sir."
They went down out of the cupola. Reynolds mounted a beautiful black horse. Buford came out into the open, saw his staff tidying itself up, combing hair, buttoning buttons. Shells were falling on the ridge nearby, and bullets were slicing leaves, but Reynolds sat astride the horse in a motionless calm, looking out toward the fight. Picture of a soldier, painted against the trees. Reynolds called in one of his officers. He said slowly, somewhat delicately, pronouncing each word in turn, evenly, machine-like, "Captain, I want you to ride as fast as you can to General Meade. Tell him the enemy is advancing in strong force, and that I am afraid they will get the heights beyond the town before I can. We will fight them here inch by inch through the town if necessary, barricading the streets. We will delay them as long as possible. I am sending messages to all my commanders to come to this place with all possible speed. Repeat that." The captain did, and was gone. Reynolds sent messages to other commanders, Doubleday, Sickles. Then he said to Buford, "I think I'll move over and hurry the boys along."
"Obliged," Buford said.
"Not at all." He wheeled the horse gracefully. Still something of that elegant quality of display in the fluid motion, and rode off. In the direction he took, Buford heard music. A blue band was playing. Buford issued his own orders. The great weight was off him. Now it belonged to Reynolds. And there was no regret. Through most of his life he had resented the appearance of higher command. Now it came to save him. A new thing. He did not mind at all. Must be the age. "Well, you have gone to the limit, lad. You have reached your own personal end." Tom Devon was up. He was annoyed to be pulled out. Buford looked at him, shook his head. In a moment, Reynolds was back, leading blue troops at double time through the fields, tearing down rail fences as they came. Buford's heart was stirred. The Black Hats, Simon Cutler's Iron Brigade. Best troops in the Union Army. An omen. They began to move out onto the road by the seminary, regiment after regiment, moving with veteran gloom, veteran silence. Steady men. Not many boys. One man was eating cherries hurriedly from a mess tin. Another had a banjo on his back, which was bothering him. And he swung it around to cover his front and banged the man in front of him, who complained to peculiar laughter. One man asked one of Buford's aides loudly, which way was the war, and offered to go the other way. And an officer turned and began sending them into line along the crest Campbell had held. Then Reynolds was back. The rebel shells were beginning to pass overhead. They had seen new troops coming, and some of the fire was falling now on Gettysburg. Reynolds summoned another aide. Lieutenant, get on into town and tell these people to stay in off the streets. There's liable to be a fair-sized dispute here today. And give anyone you meet my compliments, along with my suggestion that every person stay indoors, in cellars, if possible, and out of harm's way. Especially children. He peered at the aide. Joe, how do you see with those things on? The aide wore glasses that were very muddy. He took them and tried to clean them and smeared them with jittery fingers. A shell hit a treetop across the road and splinters flickered through the grove and spattered against the brick wall. Reynolds said pleasantly, Gentlemen, let's place the troops. He motioned to Buford. They rode out into the road. Buford felt a certain dreamy calm. Reynolds, like Lee before him, had once commanded the point. There was a professional air to him, the teacher approaching the class, utterly in command of his subject. Reynolds said, Now, John, he's got a good 15,000 men out there, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Be a lot more in a little while.
Yes. Well, between us, we can put almost 20,000 in the field in the next half hour. We're in very good shape, I think.
For a while, Buford said.
Reynolds nodded. He turned in his saddle, looked back toward the hills. Isn't that lovely ground, he said.
I thought so.
Keep at it, John. Someday, if you're spared, you may make a soldier.
He bowed his head once slightly. It came over Buford like a sunrise that he had just received Reynolds' greatest compliment. At that moment it mattered very much.
Now, Reynolds said, let's go surprise Harry Heath.
They rode out together, placing the troops. The First Corps moved into line on the left. The 11th Corps moved in behind them, swung out to the right. Through all that, the Reb cannon were firing steadily, and smoke was filling up the hollow between the armies, and no one could see the motion of the troops. The 11th was still not in line when the new Reb attack came rolling up out of the smoke. Reynolds moved off to the left, close to the line. Buford heard music, an eerie sound like a joyful wind, began to recognize it. The Campbells are coming. He recognized Rufus Dawes and the 6th Wisconsin moving up. More Wisconsin men behind them, deploying in line of skirmishers and firing already as they moved up, the line beginning to go fluid as the first Reb troops poured over a partly deserted crest and met the shock of waves of new troops coming up from the south. Buford got one last glimpse of Reynolds. He was out in the open, waving his hat, pointing to a grove of trees. A moment later, Buford looked that way, and the horse was barebacked. He did not believe it. He broke off and rode to see. Reynolds lay in the dirt road, the aides bending over him. When Buford got there, the thick stain had already puddled the dirt beneath his head. His eyes were open, half asleep, his face pleasant and composed, a soft smile. Buford knelt. He was dead. An aide, a young sergeant, was crying. Buford backed away. They put a blanket over him.
Off to the left, there was massive firing. There was a moment of silence around them.
Buford said, "Take him out of here."
He backed off. Across the road, a woman was chasing a wild-haired child. A soldier ran past her and caught the child and gave it to her. Buford went to a great shade tree and stood in the dark for a moment.
"Too good a man, Reynolds. Much too good a man."
Buford wandered slowly back out into the light. It was very hot now. He could feel sweat all down his face. A detail from a New York regiment carried Reynolds away, under a blanket. Buford's aides came to him, back to the shepherd. There were no orders to give. The battle went on without a commander. The men fought where Reynolds had placed them. Buford slowly withdrew his cavalry, as Reynolds had ordered. All the rest of that morning, gray rebel troops came pouring down that narrow road. No messages came. The line continued to hold. There did not seem to be anyone in command, but the line held. After a while, Buford mounted what was left of his cavalry and rode slowly out that road to the north. He could not hold for long, but he could hold for a little while, and the yellow-haired lieutenant was out there alone.
3. Lee.
They had stripped the rails from both sides of the road to widen the passage, and some of the men were marching in the fields. The road was already going to dust, and the dust was rising, and there was nothing to see ahead but troops in the dust toiling upward toward the crest of a divide. The bands played as he went by. He nodded, touching his cap, head cocked, listening, searching beyond the music and the noise of rolling wagons and steely clinking of sabers and guns for the distant roll of artillery which was always there, beyond the hills. They came to a narrow pass, rocky country, dark gorges, heavily wooded. He thought, if there is a repulse, this will be good country to defend. Longstreet could bring up his people and hold this place, and we would shelter the army back in the mountains. He began almost to expect it. He had seen retreat. There would be clots of men out in the fields, out far from the road, moving back the other way. Men with gray, stubborn faces who would not listen. Then there would be the wounded. But here they would block the road. No room to maneuver. If Longstreet's spy was right and there had been masses of cavalry ahead, what the blue cavalry could do to his packed troops. Lee knew that he was worrying too much, recognized it, put a stop to it. He bowed his head and prayed once quickly, then was able to relax and compose himself. He rode up into the pass and the country began to flatten out, to go down toward Cashtown. The day was hazy and he could not see far ahead. He began to pass empty houses, dark doors, dark windows. The people had fled. He entered Cashtown, and there at the crossroads, mounted, watching the troops pass, was Powell Hill. Hill was sitting with his hat down over his eyes, slouching in the saddle, a pasty illness in his face. He smiled a ghostly smile, drew himself up, saluted, waved toward a brick house just off the road. Lee said, "General, you don't look well." "Momentary indisposition," Hill grinned weakly. "Touch of the old soldier's disease. Would you like to go indoors, sir?" Lee turned to Taylor. "We will establish temporary headquarters here. All dispatches to this place." To Hill he said, "What artillery is that?" Hill shook his head, looked away from Lee's eyes. "I don't know, sir. I sent forward for information a while back. Harry Heath is ahead. He has instructions not to force some major action. I told him myself this morning." "You have no word from him?" "No, sir." Hill was not comfortable. Lee said nothing. They went to the brick house. There was a woman at the gate to whom Lee was introduced. Near her stood a small boy in very short pants sucking his thumb. Lee was offered coffee. Lee said to Hill,
I must know what's happening ahead.
Sir, I'll go myself. Hill was up abruptly, giving instructions to aides. Lee started to object, said nothing. Hill was a nervous, volatile, brilliant man. He had been a superb division commander, but now he commanded a corps. And it was a brutal military truth that there were men who were marvelous with a regiment, but could not handle a brigade, and men who were superb with a division, but incapable of leading a corps. No way of predicting it. One could only have faith in character. But to be ill on this day, very bad luck. Lee watched him. He seemed well enough to ride. Good. Hill was gone. Lee began to work on a plan of withdrawal. Moments later, Walter Taylor was in with General Anderson, who had just come into town to look for Hill. Anderson's division of Hill's corps was stacking up on the road south of town, moving in behind Pender and Heath. Anderson had come to find out about the sound of the guns. He knew nothing. Sitting in the house was galling. Lee was becoming agitated. Anderson sat by, hat in hand, watchfully. Lee said abruptly, impulsively, "I cannot imagine what's become of Stuart. I've heard nothing. You understand, I know nothing of what's in front of me. It may be the entire Federal Army." He stopped, controlled himself. But he could wait no longer. He called for Traveler and moved on out of Cashtown, toward Gettysburg. Now he could begin to hear rifle fire, the small sounds of infantry. He touched his chest, feeling a stuffiness there. So it was more than a duel of artillery. Yet Heath was not a fool. Heath would have reasons. Suspend judgment. But Jackson is not here. Ewell and Hill are new at their commands, all in God's hands. But there was pain in his chest, pain in the left arm. He could see smoke ahead, a long white cloud, low like fog on the horizon. The troops around him were eager, bright-faced. The bands were playing. He came out into a field and saw men deploying, moving out on both sides of the road, cutting away the fences. Pender's division. He put binoculars to his eyes. Troops were running in a dark grove of trees. Taylor said that Gettysburg was just ahead. Lee rode left up a flat grassy rise. Below him there was a planted field, rows of long green bush, rolling toward a creek, broken by one low rail fence and a few thick clumps of trees. Beyond the stream there was a rise, and atop the rise was a large red building with a white cupola. To the left was an open railroad cut, unfinished, a white wound in the earth. There was smoke around the building. A battery of artillery was firing from there. Lee saw blue hills to the south, in the haze, but now, sweeping the glasses, he could begin to see the lines of fire, could sense by the blots of smoke and the pattern of sound what had happened, was happening, begin piecing it together. Heath's division had formed on a front of about a mile, had obviously been repulsed. The Union infantry was firing back from a line at least as long as Heath's. There did not seem to be many cannon, but there were many rifles. Was this the whole Union force, or only an advanced detachment? Ewell was off to the north. Longstreet was miles away. What had Heath gotten himself into? The fire from Heath's front was slowing. His troops were not moving. Lee could see many wounded, wagons under trees, clusters of men drifting back through a field to the right. Aides began coming up with messages. Taylor had gone to look for Heath. Lee was thinking, how do we disengage? How do we fall back? Where do we hold until Longstreet comes up? He sent a message to Ewell to advance with all possible speed. He sent a note to Longstreet telling him that the Union infantry had arrived in force. But he knew Longstreet could do nothing. There were two divisions in his way. Lee looked at his watch. Well after 2 o'clock. Darkness a long way away. No way of knowing where the rest of Meade's army was, possibly moving to the south to get between Lee and Washington. And here at last was Harry Heath. He rode up, spattering dust, jerking at the horse with unnatural motions,
a square-faced man, a gentle face. He blinked, saluting, wiping sweat from his eyes. He had never been impulsive like Hill. There was even at this moment something grave and perplexed about him, a studious bewilderment. He had been the old army's leading authority on the rifle. He had written a manual. But he had gotten into a fight against orders.